Welcome to the DermVet Podcast. I'm Dr. Ashley Bourgeois, a board-certified veterinary dermatologist practicing in Portland, Oregon with animal dermatology clinics. I'm also a mom of two, just trying to find the balance like everyone else. Let's learn to ditch the itch, cytology, everything, and make derm more fun than frustrating. Well, it's only fitting that the first repeat guest on the podcast is Dr. Christopher Pockle, a board-certified veterinary behaviorist who owns Animal Behavior Clinic here in Portland, Oregon. He is a renowned speaker. He's involved with so many different things, and he has previously been on the podcast of December 2020. You can kind of check out that initial podcast episode we did, where we're just taking the opportunity today to dive a little deeper, really talk about some of the overlap between dermatology and dealing with chronic allergies and some behavior things that we may be able to do to better help these animals. So it's just a wonderful conversation with a wonderful person, and I'm very excited to have Dr. Pockle on the podcast today. This podcast episode is sponsored by Siva Animal Health. Well, thank you guys for coming to another episode of the DermVet Podcast. I am so excited. I didn't actually tell you, Dr. Pockle, this amazing news for you, but you are the first repeat guest.
How is that even possible? The behaviorist is the first repeat on the Derm Podcast. That is amazing. Yes.
Because I love you so much.
That works. I love you too.
You know why? Probably is just because I know so many dermatologists that it's like, I'm always excited to bring someone on. And I also know other amazing behaviorists. But I don't know, you're the one that's tied in. Take it or leave it. It's yours. So
I will take that. I love the opportunity to do these collaborative talks. You know, yeah. Me, this is my jam. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. Well, I'm very excited to have you. And then there's a reason that you are the first repeat guest. Cause we have so much fun, and we know we could do this for like a 3-hour podcast episode if we wanted to, but we will reel it in a little bit.
A little bit.
A little bit. And then maybe get people wanting more, because we do this talk also live at some conferences. So maybe people enjoy the podcast. They'll be intrigued to come see our live interaction where there's jazz hands and some singing, all by you, not me.
Right. No. We're gonna work on that for one of our upcoming presentations.
Oh gosh. Okay. I need a mimosa ahead of time.
That's fair. We can make that happen.
Excellent. I'm really excited. So we're gonna kind of go over a broad set of topics today, and really just looking at the integration of our two specialties, which we talk a lot about. We have done an episode before, so it's kind of a little bit of a sequel to that, just going a little bit deeper into some of the things that we love to talk about. So let's just start out with, you and I have talked a lot about like acrolics, different things that can cause pets to lick, whether it's behavior or allergies, obviously is what I deal with a lot, or arthritis or UTIs. So if we just look kind of at a bigger scope, like a bigger view of what types of behavior changes can be brought on by chronic disease. So, you know, whether it's pain, whether it's pruritus, like what are some of the different behavior changes? And I know this is a really big question, but just an overview of things we can see in these patients.
Yeah. You know, I love the way that the question sort of talks about it as a change rather than sort of assuming increase or decrease or, you know, something that's very specific, because, you know, when I talk about the behavioral manifestations of underlying medical conditions, it can show up in a lot of different ways. I mean, it can be the animal who's just a bit more withdrawn or is less socially interactive. It could be an animal that's more sort of clingy or needy, or, you know, is in need of support in some way, shape, or form because of the way that they're feeling. We could have animals where they are voracious in their appetite because we've got some underlying gastrointestinal malabsorption issue. We could see a loss of appetite either because of nausea or anxiety or other issues. So what I really try to counsel my clients and pet owners on is really looking for any significant deviations from normal and recognizing that we all, myself included, tend to be more alert to the things that are sort of bigger or more prevalent versus, let's say, that cat who is hiding. They're just less visible, or, you know, the animal who is eating a little bit less, but the other dog comes behind and cleans up the bowl. So we don't really notice because it's not an obvious, overt, outward expression of those things. So, you know, as we're looking for changes, really looking for any significant deviations, greater or less than normal baselines, just going, I wonder what that might be about. And we can see that across all spectrums of behavior for sure.
Well, and I think an important thing you mentioned is kind of like what's normal for that particular animal, right? Like normal is such a very similar to think about people, like normal is such a hard term to say because we're all different. I mean, it even comes down to, and you know, a different sense when I think about managing a dog with allergies and itch, you know, like if that dog is a 4, but when they saw me last time, they were a 10 on the itch scale, like, wow, we've done pretty good. Maybe saw some things to do, but we've done pretty good. Granted, if that dog's usually a 2 and now they're a 4. So like, what is normal for them? Like, what is that threshold for them? You know, these behaviors, all of our pets have different personalities. As you know, I have a pit lab mix. She's clingy by nature. So like her being more clingy, I would never probably pick up on because she's extremely clingy anyway. But then you think of cats and their behavior and, you know, a social cat who all of a sudden doesn't feel well.
Yes.
They may go isolate themselves more, or they may be the opposite and be more clingy to that owner when they're not feeling well.
Yes.
So normal is just different for all of us and all of our pets as well.
Exactly. And I know sometimes when clients are asking me, what should I look out for signs of illness for this particular animal? You know, I've been wrong just as often as I've been right when I'm trying to predict what I think this animal is going to do. And so it's really taught me over the years to really just sort of pull back and say, no, just, you know your animal better than anyone. If this is new or different, ask some questions, you know, reach out to the practitioners and just say, hey, is this difference that I'm noticing potentially concerning? Because even some things that are relatively benign changes in terms of routine could be indications of significant, potentially even life-threatening underlying illness.
It's always interesting to me when I think about like what happens at home and what happens in the clinic, because being a specialist in a very visual field, right? Like our field is probably one of the most visual ones that's out there. You know, literally our organs on the outside. But it's funny because sometimes I'll look at pets and I'll talk to owners like, well, what kind of, itch behavior are they showing at home? Like, are they licking a lot? Are they chewing a lot? Like, cause I'm deciding, you know, do we need to start something like an antipyretic or not? And sometimes the owners, you know, will say, well, they do this, but like, I don't know, like, look at them. Like, what do you think? And I'm like, well, I can tell you that I have dogs who come in and look pretty normal. And then owners will bring me videos of them incessantly chewing their paws. And then I have other dogs who come in and look awful, like completely red and ulcerative and excoriated. And then the owners like will report that they're not that itchy at home. So, you know, there's other things that affect the skin that really can matter. So that's why I was telling them it's really important for me. I'm the eyes for like a half an hour.
Yes.
I'm not the eyes like the rest of the time. So I really need to know what our threshold is and like what normal is for your particular pet, because I'm such a small synopsis at seeing this behavior of what they really are like.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Dr. Bourgeois, too, and from the standpoint of you just really trying to get a snapshot and then educating to say, hey, here's what I'm seeing. Here are some perhaps some pointers or some tips for things that I want you to look for at home. But I'm really gonna need to depend on you as an active part of this, either for implementation or for observation of efficacy. So this is a partnership right from the get-go.
Yeah, definitely. So if we see a dog that's showing some behavioral issues and say related to atopic dermatitis, let's take like the classic case that we've talked about, like, you know, say the younger lab that's getting acrylic lesions and, you know, is maybe has some behavioral changes that are kind of associated with that too. So when we think of multimodal approach, so we both use the term multimodal approach a lot, right? Like there's lots of things we've kind of done through speaking together where we see a lot of overlap of how we handle these or chronic issues we're dealing with. We're asking our owners to do a lot for us. We're not just going in and fixing it and being done. So multimodal to me tends to be, okay, we're going to bathe to repair the skin, right? Like, so that's why I love all these products that are coming out that have epidermal barrier properties to them. So using a lot of the Duxo line. So if I have a dog that comes in and they're really itchy, like, yes, I'm going to reach for medications that treat their itch, you know, a lot of the antipyretics, but what can I bathe them in that's also going to be helpful? You know, if I use something like Calm, or if they're infected, Pio, like, using stuff that have ingredients to help their skin. I'm also going to have them on good flea control. Maybe I'm putting them on a diet that's going to help their skin. So multimodal approach to me means I'm helping that skin. I'm reducing infections with the purpose of not just relying on one medication, right? I'm doing everything so we can have less of some other things. So what are some different ways we can be thinking about that? Because we're starting to talk about these pets with chronic diseases that maybe have some, I don't know if behavioral exacerbations would be a fair thing to say, but we're seeing some changes that maybe we could work on as well.
Yeah. So the way I tend to think about multimodal, just to kind of pick up there, and then we'll kind of come back to the overlap, is really, you know, anytime I'm trying to change, modify, improve the behavioral patterns or the emotional state of an animal, I tend to rely on a three-pronged approach. And that's basically to say, hey, if I want this animal to feel differently or do differently, that comes through training and behavior modification. That's sort of the teaching, the educational component of the work that we do. And that's the first prong. The second prong is basically to say, well, until that animal has learned how to feel or do differently, we're going to manage, right? So in our world, we're sort of typically avoiding exposure to situations that may be unsafe for the animal themselves or for other individuals around them, or avoiding situations where the animal may be practicing or rehearsing a particularly unwanted behavior that the more they practice, the better they get. So management is sort of this, yeah, until we've changed behavior, management is super important. And then if needed, then we're adding in medication support. And for me, medication can range anywhere from nutrition to pheromones like the Adaptyl products, to pharmaceuticals, to nutraceuticals, to herb therapy, basically anything that supports that animal and facilitates that process of reducing arousal or reducing the impact of that underlying emotional state on the behaviors that they are displaying. So I think about all of that. And then I say, okay, well, you know, that's assuming that we're really focusing only on the behavioral components. That's all sort of built on the foundation of saying, have we met that animal's basic needs, emotional and physical needs, and the needs of their physical health? And that's where some of these overlapping conditions really come in. Meaning if we have pain or discomfort, whether that's coming from osteoarthritis or chronic pruritus or itch levels, what we tend to find is that for an animal who is in a mild state or moderate or even severe state of physical distress, that affects some of the same physiology on the inside, basically, you know, changing cortisol levels and adrenaline levels and looking at, you know, the ways in which their body responds. And so anything that's sort of kicking into that stress response system tends to move that animal closer to that threshold at which observable behavioral changes are going to be evident. So we think about the animal who, let's say, ordinarily tolerates the toddler kind of fussing with their ears, for example, and they're like, yeah, I don't love it. And after about 15 seconds, I get up and I move away because that's really my preference here. Well, if we have physical discomfort coming from anywhere, that 15 seconds may only be 8 seconds. It may only be 2 seconds. It may show up differently in terms of the expression there as well. Rather than standing up and walking away, there'd be more of a defensively aggressive reaction as well. So I really need to make sure that before I just dive in and start talking about the behavioral stuff, we've done as good a job as possible to say, have we met the physical, emotional health needs of that animal first? And that's where I'm reaching out to folks like you to say, hey, I got an itchy dog. I'm seeing redness. I got some lesions here. You know, it smells like yeast, but I've learned my lessons to not diagnose Malassezia based on smell alone. See, I pay attention too.
Look at you.
So I'm going to need some help here. Collaboration. What do we do next? And then we take it from there.
Well, I am extremely proud of you. Yes, because yes, we do not diagnose. I like to say we don't have microscopic eyes. So we don't diagnose based on our eyes. without the assistance of a microscope. And we definitely do not diagnose it based on our nose. Cause I was fooled by one just this week where I took like five cytologies because I was absolutely sure I was going to find yeast somewhere based on how it looked and smelled. And all I could find was bacteria. So, you know, I'm very excited that you mentioned that, but yeah, everything you said is just so important. And you know, as we've done these talks together, like we've talked a lot about, we want to put certain cases in a vacuum and say, okay, well, you're allergic, you have this, you know, fix that and then it will fix you. But then the reality knows we already have so many layers just based on our specialty alone. My specialty, it's like, okay, we're allergic. What are we allergic to? Then we get infections. Well, we have a few, we can get infections on the skin. We can get infection in the ears. Okay, great. So then we have to have flea control. Like there's so many things that can cause discomfort, not just the disease itself, but then all the chronic infections that we deal with too. Yes. And I've probably told you the story before, but I just remember this dog when I was in my residency that had really bad ear disease. And when it first came in, the owners kind of, you know, warned me, we're going to have to muzzle, didn't like anyone messing with it. It was very fearful. It was very painful. And so, you know, we kind of got our exam done with the owner, and started treating the animal, came back for its recheck, you know, like 3 weeks later. Now the animal was letting me look in the ears, wasn't reactive, wasn't being a little fearful still, but wasn't really reacting as much. By the second recheck, I went in, was talking to the owner. I was sitting on the floor about to examine the dog. The dog literally came up and curled up in my lap. So like just showing the behavior and how it's a really manifestation of so many things. And it's like, yes, we wanted to say, we'll do this and they'll be better. And really they're complex medical things we deal with, and they're complex animals. Like, yeah, we really have to look at all of these different things. And that's why, as we kind of start thinking about different ways we can treat these pets, whether it's just the primary disease that I tend to deal with, or like you mentioned, using things like Adaptyl, or, you know, looking at that pet and saying what needs to happen now while they're painful. Maybe we don't let the kids crawl on that pet. You know, we've talked about side effects with certain medications. Maybe when we really figure out what that means for that pet and what we do to alleviate it, rather than just say, well, that doesn't work. So it's really important. And I've learned a lot through the talks we've done about how to look at these cases a little bit differently. So this is actually an interesting question. I'm kind of curious to hear your thoughts on. So talking about behavior. So we talk about, when we've done talks in the past about acrolics, we talk about all the different causes of them. You know, yes, absolutely can be allergies, but you can see some behavior things that cause that. We can see arthritis that causes that. So if we think about things like licking and chronic behaviors, what are your thoughts where, say it's an allergic dog and they've been allergic for a long time, we get rid of the infections, we feel like we have the allergies well controlled. Can there be some residual kind of behaviors like that licking, maybe learned? And I hear owners say that a lot, like, oh, they're bored, or, you know, they've just learned to do that. They learn to groom themselves. What are your thoughts on kind of residual behaviors after we have treated that primary disease process?
Yeah, it's certainly something that can happen. And I tend to, whether I'm talking with a client or other practitioners, I tend to unpack the learning component of that. Basically, we say, well, if a behavior, you know, observable behavior like licking, using that example, if it's something that is ongoing, and especially if it's gotten worse, that tells us, based on the laws of behavior, that there's been reinforcement. Something has strengthened that pattern. So then my brain says, okay, cool. It's ongoing and or has gotten worse. That tells me that there's a reinforcer present in some way, shape, or form. So the first reinforcer could be what we were talking about with the medical condition, right? So licking might alleviate pain or discomfort. So that's considered basically if the animal then feels better as a result of licking, it's actually a negative reinforcer. No, I'm not going to get into all of the quadrants and behavior change today. Just trust me on that one.
And 3 hours later,
right? Exactly. Like I got the whiteboard at the ready. Let's do it. Let's go. No. But we get that sort of a reinforcement through the alleviation of discomfort. In other cases, we could have an animal that, let's say, starts to engage in more of a repetitive licking pattern. And maybe this is an animal that is predisposed to more of a compulsive or stereotypic repetitive pattern. That reinforcement could actually be internal from more of an endorphin stress relieving standpoint, especially if there's an emotional component to that animal's patterns as well. And so that reinforcement could be internal. It could also be external, meaning if that owner, for example, had gotten in the habit of interrupting the dog or attempting to interrupt the dog for licking, because perhaps it was really super annoying to hear that licky, slurpy sound that, ugh.
It is. It is really super annoying.
It's not good, right? So from a learning standpoint, if the dog is, then has, I don't want to say is just getting attention, because sometimes that attention that yields is not good attention. But by the same token, if this is a dog who, coming back to the board comment, if this is a dog who is even somewhat insufficiently stimulated when it comes to owner interactions, and now licking yields a response, that can accidentally reinforce those behavior patterns as well, where it becomes almost a self-perpetuating problem or pattern. So it's a really complicated or complex situation to try to say, let's do the best we can to make sure that the primary cause has been alleviated, managed, reduced, eliminated, what have you. And if it's ongoing, then we often are then looking at some of those other reinforcement patterns to say, hey, what's still present here? Do we need to address, again, whether it's a stereotypic patterns, whether it's an underlying anxiety issue where the animal is licking because of now almost more of a stress or displacement pattern, or do we need to really provide some coaching to the owner to help them understand how to interact differently so that external reinforcement is no longer a motivating factor for that particular animal?
Yeah, that is really interesting. One kind of follow-up question to that is, so, you know, say I'm dealing with that case, I feel like, man, and this is super hard because there's really no way, when we talk about pets that are itchy, if I think there's like a behavioral component and an allergic component, how do you really differentiate those? Like, am I doing a great job with my therapy? I feel like I am, but we know there's difficult cases that just don't respond to traditional antipyretics. So then that's really tough. So when I'm dealing with this case, say the lab that's been licking, I feel like I've done everything I should do. For the most part, the skin and ear is looking pretty good, but we're still doing some, say, carpal licking. I'm in between if it's a methodical soothing lick or if an allergic itch. When do I say, Dr. Pockle, I think you need to see this case, or I need to get your eyes on it? What are some kind of tips you'd have of when it's time to get a behaviorist involved?
Yeah, I think, you know, anytime a practitioner, whether they're a specialist or a generalist or, you know, whatever the discipline is, anytime I have a practitioner who says, this isn't responding the way that I thought it would, or this is stretching my limits of knowledge in this particular area, I'm always a fan of saying, hey, what would involving that specialist look like? And I say involving the specialist because that's kind of the angle that we're going here. For me, it actually oftentimes means I'm going back and asking the generalist when I get some of the questions coming to me about, hey, what should I do for vaccine schedules or sort of routine wellness and diet management? I'm like, nope, that's above my pay grade. That needs to go back to your GP team, because I haven't thought about that truly, you know, in a comprehensive way since 2004. So yeah, I'm a little outdated in my knowledge base. So, you know, this is not, you know, to always to say that the specialist is the end all be all. This is a collaboration, you know, sideways, totally, up, down, whatever angle we need to go.
So like our own dogs have GPs. Literally someone the other day, I was talking about my dog going to see a general practitioner, and she's like, but you're a vet. I was like, I don't listen to my dog's heart. I don't listen to their lungs. Like, if something happens, I need someone who knows what they're doing. And it is not me. I got her allergies, that I'm good with. And the general practitioner, like, as we're talking, I'm like, yeah, she has atopia. She's like, yeah, I'm going to guess you have a handle on that. I was like, well, she's, I don't know if she's like super well controlled. I'm trying, but she's like, yeah, I'm not messing with any of that. I was like, fair enough.
Yeah, I do the same thing. I'm like, I got the behavior stuff under control. If you'd like to know what I'm doing, I'm happy to share, but yeah, I'm good there. But I got no clue in the rest. So honestly, for me, anytime I'm working with a practitioner who says, there's stuff going on here I don't fully understand, or it's not responding to the therapy that I thought it should respond to, I'm a huge fan of you know, creating a reach out at that point in time. And whether that's actually a referral or whether it's picking up the phone and saying, hey, what can we do here? Knowing that at least through my practice, we offer a variety of things. Meaning if it's a, you know, if it's a 2-minute question, that we just have a very specific question, myself and my other doctors in the practice, we're more than happy to answer that. And if there is more of a, we're going to have to dive in, you know, this is a 4-year-old female spayed pit mix with blah, 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 the moment we start going down that path, we're probably going to need at least 15 to 20 minutes to really do it any justice whatsoever. So we schedule those as 30-minute vet-to-vet consults as a way to be able to say, hey, let's actually give you the attention that you need to not only answer your questions, but help you to understand the framework within sort of how and why we're answering them in a particular way. And, you know, in that case where we have that dog that, say, is licking on an ongoing basis, I'm a huge fan for saying, and can you supply a couple of short 30 or 60 second video clips along with that scheduling request so that I can actually look at the subtlety, because I'm not going to be able to tease out all of the levels of detail from a description that I would be able to get from actually looking at that animal in real time, watching the interplay of, you know, of that animal with their own body, as well as how they're interacting with the environment. Classic case even is, you know, you've showed me a video of the cat who was paritically scratching and biting and chewing within consult with a complete lack of awareness of everything that was going on around it. That's not normal from a behavioral standpoint. That's an animal who's experiencing more of a neurosensory itch, pain, discomfort, something that that animal is trying to alleviate or soothe. So body language is the place where my visual capacity really starts to kick in there. And I got to get a closer look to really be able to weigh in if possible.
Yeah. And I think as we talk about normal and thresholds, every owner has a different threshold, right? Like some owners are super willing to go get, just even if it's consult with you, I'm not sure this is behavior related, or we could do these like conservative things, but I don't think we have to do anything big. Fine. You know, we just know that some owners are not going to go for it. I mean, same goes with me. Owners are vets ask, well, when should I refer? And it's like, well, I have kind of like my general list of things I can tell you, but I'm super happy to see the pet that's doing well on medication, but they just want an allergy test because they want to be proactive. They don't have to be a disaster, you know, but those are proactive owners. Not everyone's like that. But then there's certain things where we're dealing with lots of multi-drug resistant bacterial infections all the time. Like, of course I want to see those patients. So, you know, again, there's things we can say, but there's different threshold of owners where if you have one, we're even kind of slightly concerned, just ask, like, yes, would you be willing to go see this other specialist? Like, you know, at least get their thoughts on it. I do that with surgeons a lot when we have ear cases where they're a little nervous about Tikas. And I'm like, I really think your dog needs one. I can tell you the stuff I know about that surgery, but I don't do the surgery. You definitely don't want me doing that. So I've already failed the ear at this point. So I'm like, just go talk to them. Oncology, you know, a lot of times we biopsy, yes, certain skin cancers, and owners are like, what are the recommendations? I'm like, I kind of remember certain things, but there could be a new drug that's come out and I don't even know. So I'm like, just commit to the consult, like, you know, ask them the consult fee, get the information. That's what the consult's for. And then make, you know, educated decisions based on what you can do. So kind of same thing. Like if you have owners that are be proactive, just ask. I've had owners, yeah, where I'm kind of like, I think you should see a behaviorist. I think you should see, you know, a surgeon. And they don't. And then I'll kind of mention it again at the next one. And then all of a sudden the third time of just saying it very nicely and politely, like, you know, I'm still really concerned that there might be an underlying behavior problem that's not really in my wheelhouse. Then all of a sudden, you know, they may be open to it because it's kind of sunk in a little bit more. Spinning off of that a little bit and talking about owners, because I know both of us are super passionate about communication. And we do deal with having to communicate and talk to owners a lot. Again, we are not usually specialties where it's one and done. It is, you will know my children's names by the end of our journey together. I mean, half the time when I went through both my pregnancies working, like I just had a client the other day that hadn't been in for a while. And she's like, Oh, you had another baby, didn't you? Like, you know, they really get to know us, which, you know, yes, I know we love, but we do overwhelm them. I mean, it's very overwhelming to deal in our specialties as far as all the things that we can do.
Yes.
So when we start talking about that multimodal approach, not necessarily even just, you know, bathing and this and that, but say we are going to maybe start some behavior modifications. We are going to, you know, mix in some adaptable for that dog where maybe there is a behavioral component. You know, maybe we are going to try to use feel away, though we both know over grooming cats, like for the most part, you can go back to the other episode, are going to be more of a dermatologic issue. But dogs, I think, are a bigger gray zone as far as that goes. How do we kind of not overwhelm the owners trying to start to implement some of these things? And I will preface that with saying, I think this is extremely owner dependent.
Yes.
But what are some tips that you have for veterinarians out there when we say, okay, you're giving Apoquil, you're bathing, you know, you're bathing and doing mousse, you're on good flea control. I have changed your food. You know, we're going to do this topical fatty acid plus let's try this behavior modification. What do you think?
Yeah, it's tricky. And you're absolutely right. It's incredibly owner and household and animal dependent in terms of sort of what's possible, what's doable. And as you and I have talked about before, you know, the best treatment plan is the one that can get done, right? It's the one that the owner is able to commit to and then do. And then we can decide whether it's enough or whether we need to modify from there. But the way that I tend to think about it is, you know, I'll often come at it kind of from a high level overview first. And even as I was describing that three-pronged approach of behavior mod, you know, and then until that time, we're going to be looking at management, and then we're going to be potentially looking at medication. I may even start there and ask the question or a few questions around saying, hey, based on what I've shared with you so far, like, are you like super passionate about diving into the training side of things? Are you a little bit overwhelmed right now and we really just kind of need to quiet the storm a little bit? Or you're really looking for a prescription because anything else is going to be a challenge for you. Just, you know, shoot from the hip. Tell me what you're thinking so far. I know I haven't given you any specifics yet. Just let me know kind of what's resonating with you. How is that landing? And that kind of starts to get me in the ballpark. Oh, this is a client who says, no, I really don't want any sort of medications. I'm not a fan of pharmaceuticals. Cool. Then I'm going to have to lean on those other two prongs a little bit more heavily. Or vice versa, you know, and then I can start to say, okay, let's say we're utilizing medication as part of our plan. Are you skewing more in the pheromone direction? Are we going to manipulate diet and look at that aspect? Are we going to be looking more at pharmaceuticals? What's your background? What's your preference? Knowing that I always tell my clients, I am more than happy, if you want, I'm more than happy to tell you what I think is the best option here. But you actually know your dog, and you probably, as most of my clients do, have some significant biases based on your time, your experiences, your budget. And so I want to honor that as best I can. And so, you know, I think that the last thing that I'll say here too is that, you know, when I'm thinking about a multimodal approach, yeah, I'm building that comprehensive plan in my head. I'm saying, cool, here's the seven things I want your dog to know. Here's the four things that I want to do from a management standpoint. Here are seven options that we've got from a med standpoint. But I'm not going to overload the client with all 15 of those things. It's a matter of saying, hey, let's do two or three things really well, maybe three or four if it's a really severe case or there's a level of urgency here. But let's do a couple of things really well. And that's going to depend on practitioner experience as to what you think is going to be most meaningful for that particular animal. And that's also a place too where we can lean on one another as practitioners. Hey, I've got the option of going forward with this treatment versus this one. I know you don't know, you know, a lot about this case yet, but do you generally have a preference? Cool. Happy to share thoughts.
Yeah, I think that's really great. And sometimes what I think is interesting, and you probably find this too, is we get owners who already have a really big knowledge base because they've already had a pet with a similar issue. Like I've had lots of clients who come in and it's like, I've had a dog with allergies before, so I'm super familiar with immunotherapy. And it's like, okay, great, we're going to do that plus all these other things because they already have that foundation there. And you probably deal with that too, where you have some owners who are really maybe passionate about helping pets that have behavioral issues or aggression issues. And so they've dealt and already had some training done, or they dealt with these situations before. And so they're a little bit more, you know, and then throw on maybe they're atopic or something like that, they're a little bit more open to really diving into more things at once. But it really is a lot about kind of reading the client, seeing what they're willing to do. Sometimes there's multiple problems, but they're more worried about one thing than anything else. So like for me, I may have a pet who comes in and they have, you know, they have some mild allergies, but really it's like the ears are such a disaster. That is their concern. That's what we're focusing on. And we really have to focus on that. You know, we could have cases where if they are allergic and we're kind of managing that, but there are other things that they're more worried about, like behavior issues or internal issue, like maybe we're more focused on that. And then we kind of come back to that. So multimodal, I feel like can have really lots of layers to it. You can have to talk about multimodal for that disease, but at the end, it's an entire pet. And yes, we have to really look at that entire pet. And that's where I think we are starting to get some more interest in some of these things, like especially with your field, like you really can overlap with just about anybody, because we talk about, okay, we have a dog who's, for me, really allergic, like painful ears, changes their behavior. So do we manage that disease? Is there residual behavior? Are there things we have to do? Do we look into things like you said, like the pheromones or other maybe more conservative management things? Do we need a trainer involved because of these certain issues? You could overlap with a dog recovering from surgery, I'm going to guess, that maybe has a lot of stress and anxiety and other things that you're dealing with. So yeah. There's a lot of like overlapping things here. And at the end of the day, it's a multimodal approach for that pet. Like whether it's they got one specialist or one of those unfortunate dogs who has like five specialists that we meet.
Yeah, so that's I love the fact that you highlight the ability for behavior to overlap multiple disciplines. Because I think about, you know, surgeons, for example. So my significant other, who's downstairs prepping dinner now, I'm sort of listening to the kitchen, like, ooh, I wonder what's happening down there.
Like, wrap it up so I can eat.
Like, we got a couple minutes left here. No, you know, with his discipline, for example, you know, there's so many elements where, let's say it's a dog that's going to be coming in for a TPLO repair, right? So we're scheduling this out, whether it's a week or a month or even further in some cases, you know, asking some of those questions, like, is this a dog that currently tolerates confinement? Because if it doesn't, we got some work to do in the short term, you know, whether that's trialing drugs like trazodone to try to facilitate management, or whether that's introducing crating or other confinement options, or to say, wow, this is a dog historically has needed to run and do 5 hours a day. And guess what? It's got an Achilles tendon rupture and it needs to be on strict cage rest or it's not going to work. So, you know, what do we need to learn about mental enrichment that doesn't require as much physical activity? So we can, you know, we can dovetail on the surgical side there, even thinking about things like oncology, for example. You know, if we're talking about an animal that's going to be coming back into the veterinary clinic frequently for individual treatments, or the clients are going to be going through home care of whatever that looks like, or we're monitoring you know, appetite or monitoring for other signs of infection or inflammation, we're looking at behavioral changes there too, and either monitoring for stress or a lack of a stress response that may give us more of an indication of how that pet is feeling. So there's so many overlaps that we could tease out here when we really look at, you know, quite honestly, as one of my colleagues is known for saying, it's all behavior. Right? Everything we observe is behavior. Why the animal is behaving may come from a variety of different disciplines, but dang, behavior touches everything, everything truly.
Yeah. No, we all have personalities. We all have things that we exhibit. We all have, you know, our little nuances, and pets are just the same. Just they get exacerbated potentially by certain things that we're dealing with. Okay. Last question, because I don't want to hold you up from your, whatever. I mean, I'm sitting here by myself. Like, I'm probably the one having to figure out dinner, or having leftovers. So I just want to know when you're going to have me over, so my dinner is being made by now. So in your opinion, as a behaviorist, what should we be considering moving forward for the mental aspect of dogs or cats? We can throw cats in there with chronic skin disease. So like, let's really back in and get back to just skin, though I know you could bounce around to everybody. So when we talk about these dogs and cats who are, you know, they're primarily obviously itchy because of a, say, allergic disease. What do we need to be thinking about, or what can we change as far as thinking of that mental aspect of it, whether it is they are having a rip-roaring ear infection, so maybe we keep them separate from, you know, kids for a while if they're really painful, or just little things like that that we could be doing differently.
Yeah, this could really go in a lot of different directions, as you said, sort of based on the temperament, based on the household, based on the individual behavior patterns of the animal. So I try to encourage my clients and other practitioners to really be open and even asking a few questions. You know, let's say, for example, we have that animal who needs to be, let's say it's something that is actually communicable, or it's going to be infectious, you know, in a particular way, and we have to rely on segregation. Or maybe it's the animal who has an ear infection and the other dog won't stop licking its ears, you know, so like, oh yeah. My God, we have to manage this dog separately. So even asking the question, hey, this is what I think our next step looks like. Do you anticipate any complications? Or even perhaps a better question, what complications can you already foresee? Almost making that assumption that there's something about this recommendation that's problematic for you, because it's a big deal. I'm asking you to make changes to your routine in a way that's not usual. So what can you already forecast? Because if you let me know that, oh my gosh, no, this aspect of it's going to be really, really hard, maybe it's the bathing piece that's really, really hard, or maybe it is the social isolation piece, or it's the fact that, you know, the dog is not sleeping well at night because of this itch level. And so we now have a sleep deprived animal, and that's showing up as irritability and agitation and an exacerbation of anxiety issues. Like, tell me what you're thinking about for this animal. Again, you know them better than I do. What do you think is going to be problematic here? And so I tend to come at it from a place of curiosity first versus assuming that I know because I've spent 8 minutes with that client, or 38 minutes even with that client, that I therefore know all of the ins and outs of their world and their personalities and what's going to be problematic. So rather than assuming, I tend to ask a lot of questions, as I know that you do as well, because it's so important to really meeting the clients, maybe meeting their needs and the animal's needs as well.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me a lot when I think about asking owners if they can diet trial. Like, it's kind of the same thing. It's easy to say, here, feed this food. But then I always kind of ask, like, do you think it can be strict? Exactly. Like, what complications do you see?
Do you have a toddler?
Oh my gosh. Like, do you have a toddler? Do you have like grandparents?
Do you have a grandmother?
That come over? Like, yeah. Yeah. Is it, you know, right now we're recording this like at the end of October, like holidays are coming up. Like, honestly, I ask owners, like, holidays yes. are coming up. Like, we're in that 2 month mark. So are you going to be able to do this or not? So like you said, it's kind of the only assuming I would say is assuming there is going to be an obstacle yes. because that's just real life. Yes. And I've experienced that having my own allergic dog. I can empathize with owners, but like sometimes they're almost ashamed. Like I recently had an owner who couldn't get into me right away for various reasons, like life and finances, all these things. And she came in almost like thinking I was going to be upset with her. And I was like, listen, I get it. Like, it's hard. Yeah. You're coming in now. Like, let's fix now. Like, you know, that's the important thing. And just kind of empathizing with owners, it's really hard to get into vet clinics right now. So even when vets are flaring, you can't get in the next day most of the time. So it's just kind of like communicating with them, empathizing with them. But like you said, it's like giving them that out of, I expect there to be an obstacle. So tell me what it is. And let's see if it's over, we can overcome it or not. Yeah. And then we can kind of decide what's next. So I think that's a lot of overlap, especially when we are talking about all these things we could do with these pets, like, you know, the behavioral changes, the dermatologic changes, and probably some marriage of both of these in a lot of these cases that are dealing sure. with chronic diseases.
Yeah. I think the only other comment that I'll make too, as we kind of sort of look at this overlap piece too, is that I sometimes get practitioners who are asking, you know, sort of when to sort of dive in on the behavioral side, even at a basic level. And, you know, and my honest answer is, you know, let's say you're dealing with that paritic dog who appears to be stressed and you think, I think it's all physical. Well, maybe. But if that animal is experiencing even the slightest bit of emotional discomfort because of a physical issue, if there are options for supporting that animal, you know, whether I sort of mentioned this whole list of things, whether it's pharmaceuticals, whether it's food, whether it's, you know, looking at pheromones, whether it's nutraceuticals, whatever we can do, you know, something like, hey, your dog is really stressed out right now. And this adaptive plugin, you know, in the main living area may help to alleviate the emotional discomfort until we can get the physical issues under control. Is that something you're open to doing? You know, let's try it, right? So rather than saying, no, we have to fix the physical stuff first, if we can support that emotional component, that may, and I'm going to stress the word may, we don't have a lot of research yet. We're learning about how supporting the animal's emotional systems can facilitate healing, whether that's through better sleep, whether it's better immune function, whether it's, you know, again, reducing cortisol levels and some of those stress hormones. We can facilitate healing by also incorporating emotional health parameters into our treatment plan. So there's almost never a time where it's too soon to think about the emotional well-being of the animal. If we can support them, let's do it. Let's go for it.
I mean, I totally agree. That sounds awesome. We don't need to just see the disasters. Like,
exactly.
I would love to fix them before they even have to be disasters. Like, so I'm sure you feel the same way. Like, you are okay seeing the cases that you just know that you can prevent things from getting worse. You can do things that are more conservative. You know, we can intervene early, be more preventative with some of these things rather than having to be, I guess, in your field, something like, okay, no, now it's a problem because we tried to bite someone, or now it's a problem because it's a stress on our household. Like, we can really intervene with some of these therapies, some of these opinions from specialists, you know, educating ourselves, working with the clients to a point where that we're actually being on that preventative mindset rather than, oh, now you've reached the threshold where you have to go see the specialist, and we're already way behind the eight ball at that point.
Agreed. Yes.
So, well, I love it. Well, Dr. Pockel, it's always a pleasure. I know you're hungry. So I wish I didn't live on the other side of town of you so I could just come over and get some food. But no, it's always so much fun. And I just really, truly appreciate you being first round number two. It must have done something right, because you agreed to it when I asked you to be back on. So
it's always a pleasure. No, and I love, you know, I love being able to walk away from these conversations to truly learning something each and every time, whether it's something about the word choice or the discussion, you know, way in which we're discussing issues with clients, or whether it's learning about new products, or again, there's so many collaborative opportunities that exist here. So I'm always willing to say yes when you pop into my inbox, or when I get that text coming through on the phone saying, hey, do you want to?
Yes.
When Dr. Bourgeois says, do you want to? I say yes. Just tell me where to show up.
You better watch out. You can get in trouble with that, because you're going to end up like every other podcast. No, it's always a good time. And just thank you so much for being here.
You're certainly welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Well, as you can tell, Chris and I always have an amazing time talking about our two specialties and things that we're really passionate about. I think it's really interesting just to dive into some of the overlap we see of these cases. As we talked about, I mean, behavior kind of really can be involved in anything that we're dealing with. So really, to better help these pets, we want to make sure that we're really taking into consideration that multimodal approach and, you know, what we really have to think about in improving the quality of life of that pet beyond just managing their itch. Of course, I love managing allergies. It's what I do, but I think it's really interesting to get these other thoughts and concepts on how we can help these animals. Thank you so much to Siva for sponsoring this podcast episode. If you have any other ideas for future podcast episodes, feel free to reach out on my Instagram, The Derm Vet, or my website, thedermvet.com.